This will be the Multiple Creations Theory Under Scrutiny, Part 5. In the first two messages of this series, I proved that neither man nor the living creatures found in Genesis chapter 1 are the creation of the other races. In our last two messages, we've been examining the passages which, according to some, quote-unquote, prove that the beasts of the field are the other races of mankind, or more specifically, the Negro race of mankind. Now, in last week's message, we first examined 12 of the most commonly used passages or proof text for this theory for the beasts of the field. But we found that they can prove absolutely nothing about beasts in Genesis 1 and 2, about them being anything. For the reason, as you should well know by now, that they were in every single passage, they used the wrong Hebrew word, kehi, or excuse me, they used the wrong Hebrew word, behema, rather than the correct Hebrew word, kehi, as found in Genesis 1 and 2. And so in these 12 most commonly or most popularly used proof texts for this theory, they absolutely fall to the wayside because as I mentioned in last week's message, you cannot prove anything about kehi by looking at passages which use behema. Next, we began examining passages sometimes used which use the right Hebrew word. Thus far, in last week's message, at the end of last week's message, we examined four such passages and found that even though they use the right Hebrew word, there is still nothing human proven from the word kehi in those particular passages. So, what I want to do now is pick up where we left off, because there's four more yet to be looked at that are sometimes used, that use the right word, the right Hebrew word, in the verse, that they sometimes use to try to prove that beast of the earth or beast of the field are human or Negro. Let's pick up and go to Exodus chapter 23. Exodus 23, in verses 10 and 11. Here's what it says. And you shall sow your land for 6 years and gather in its yield. But on the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, so that the needy of your people may eat, and whatever they leave the beast, kehi, in this case, same Hebrew word as found in Genesis 1:24, and whatever they leave the beast of the field may eat. You are to do the same thing with your vineyard and your olive grove. So in these particular two verses, we find the same phrase, beast of the field, herein used, translated from the right Hebrew word. Now let me give you our latest preacher's argument concerning this passage. Here's what he says, quote, "Now we get into the diet of these creatures. The Israelites, I believe, possess servants." And I agree with that. Matter of fact, it's easily proven from the Scriptures. Then he goes on, "And I believe that they were the beast of the field." And I emphatically disagree with that. Then continuing, he says, now for fear of reasoning deductively, let's turn over to Exodus 23 in verses 10 and 11 and let the Scripture speak for itself, end quote. Then he reads Exodus 23, 10 and 11 on the tape. And then he continues and says, quote, now in this Scripture we have additional positive proof that the beasts of the field were not domestic animals, for they do not eat grapes and olives, end quote. Now, again he said, we have additional positive proof that the beasts of the field were not domestic animals, for they do not eat grapes and olives. And you know what? He's right. In this case, behema is not the Hebrew word used for beasts, which would normally be used if it was speaking of domestic animals. You know, it's a complete change around now here. Before, it was always wild animals, and yet it was always behema, which was the word used for domestic animals. This time, he's saying they can't be domestic animals, and yet it's the word that's normally used for wild animals, as we will prove and see in the rest of this message. In this case, he's right. Again, he said, we have additional positive proof that the beasts of the field were not domestic animals. He's right. They're not domestic animals. Domestic animals, I don't know of any, and there may certainly be some, but there are no domestic animals, to my knowledge, that eat olives and grapes. Occasionally, maybe some grapes would be eaten by a cat or a dog. I don't know. But, I mean, normally. And on top of it, it's the wrong Hebrew word for domestic animals. It's kehi. This time they need to camp on kehi, and they don't do it. It's kehi here rather than the other. In this case, they can make a distinction between man and domestic animals, not man and wild animals. And for this reason, too, because wild animals, there are wild animals which eat grapes and olives. And I really don't think that's a point to be made in this passage anyway, because it's talking about the field in this passage, laying fallow, and the olive groves for both man and beast. Well, even if there are no wild beasts that eat grapes and olives, which indeed there are, even if there weren't, it's not necessarily referring the beast to that part of the passage. It may be just talking about what's in the field. So it's, again, you can see the way they want to just try to stretch these scriptures to make them say something they don't say at all. Instead, kehi is the Hebrew word that's used here, and we will see that it is used for wild animals, and again, wild animals will eat olives and grapes. So nothing can be proven. Not only that, but we find a similar passage to this one, actually a reiteration of this passage, found in Leviticus 25. Turn there, if you would. Leviticus 25, and I want to read verses 1 through 7. Starting with verse 1, it says, Yahweh then spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying, Speak to the sons of Israel, and say to them, When you come into the land which I shall give you, then the land shall have a Sabbath to Yahweh. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in its crop. Excuse me. But during the seventh year, the land shall have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to Yahweh. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard. Your harvest aftergrowth you shall not reap, and your grapes of untrimmed vines you shall not gather. The land shall have a sabbatical year. Verse 6, And all of you shall have the Sabbath products of the land for you, for food, excuse me, yourself and your male and female slaves, and your hired hand, and your foreign resident, those who live as aliens with you, even your cattle, number 929, behemoth, and the animals, I would suspect King James has beasts there, number 2416, kehi, that are in your land shall have all its crops to eat. Now, keep in mind that this speaker that I quoted wants to make slaves equal with beasts. But note in verse 6 and 7 that there's a distinction made between first Israelites, slaves, foreigners or strangers, non-Israelites, and beasts. In other words, beasts, they make a distinction between the slaves and the beasts. Not only between the slaves and the beasts, but between the beast and all non-Israelites. They were something different than Israelites. They were something different than non-Israelites. They were something different than slaves. They were something different than hired help. And they were something different than domestic animals. And what's that leave? Wild animals. See, during the sabbatical year, it was open for all to partake of. Whether it be, you know, God's concern in regard to this statute was for the Israelites, for their slaves or servants, for the foreigner, the domestic animals, and even the wild animals. And it just would have happened. The wild animals, they wouldn't have been chased out of the fields. They did during that sabbatical year, the fields were left alone. And so the animals would have gotten in and taken care of whatever their needs would have been as well. And consequently, nothing can be proven again human about the beast found here in this passage. In each of these situations, or in each category, each would have free access during the sabbatical year to whatever they eat, whether it be from the fields, the groves, or the vineyards. And again, nothing is here proven about beast of the field being human. Let's go to our next passage now. Let's go to Exodus chapter 28. Exodus 28, and we also with this want to look at a similar passage used in Deuteronomy 7. But we will begin with Exodus 28, starting with verses 28 through 30. Exodus 28, 28. And they shall bind the breast piece by its rings to the rings of the ephod. Wait a minute, this doesn't look right. Excuse me, it's Exodus 23. Exodus 23, 28. And I will send hornets ahead of you, that they may drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites before you. And I will not drive them out before you in a single year, that the land may not become desolate. And the beast of the field, kehi, for beast there, and the beast of the field become too numerous for you. I will drive them out before you, little by little, until you become fruitful and take possession of the land. Then quickly turn over to Deuteronomy 7, where we find a very similar passage and promise by God. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 22 in this case. If you're not there, I'll just read it. It says, "And Yahweh your God will clear away these nations before you little by little. You will not be able to put an end to them quickly, lest the," New American Standard says, "wild beast grow too numerous for you." Okay? Now, these passages, first of all, these passages in and by themselves, just simply by themselves, cannot prove either position regarding Kehi. In other words, they can't prove that Kehi are human, neither can they prove that Kehi are simply animals. The reason being is because either wild beast, or in certain cases, even Negroes, could do what is being suggested of in these passages. That is, take over the land if it was deserted too quickly by the white race or any race of people. And so in and by these passages, to try to make this prove that these people, or these creatures, were people or human beings or Negroes, just cannot be done. But let's see if we can't look at another passage which doesn't shed light on it, and which will help determine which is the correct position. In and by themselves, you can't prove anything. But let's look at Leviticus, two more passages actually, Leviticus 26, 21 and 22, with 2 Kings 17, 25. Now, Leviticus 26 is again very similar to the first two passages we quoted, or that I read. Leviticus 26, now verses 21 and 22, it says, "If then you act with hostility against me," God's now giving the reason why this may happen, "if then you act with hostility against me and are unwilling to obey me, I will increase the plague on you seven times according to your sins. And I will let loose among you the beast of the field, which shall bereave you of your children and destroy your cattle and reduce your number so that your roads lie deserted." Again, the word translated beast here is kehi, so we're talking about the same creatures. In this case, God says, in the previous two cases, he says, "I'm not going to drive out all these other peoples so that the kehi don't take over the land." In this case, he says, "If you don't obey me, I'm going to let the kehi come in and devour you." So, are the kehi here human or non-human? Well, let's go to 2 Kings chapter 17. And we'll find in this passage where God's promise is fulfilled and beasts are interpreted here for us, or what is meant in these other passages by beast. 2 Kings 17, verse 25, it says, "And it came about at the beginning of their living there that they did not fear Yahweh," so they were not doing what he warned them to do. And then he says, "Therefore Yahweh sent," not in this case, not beast. He gets specific. "Lions among them, which killed some of them." This is a fulfillment of what God said would happen for those people who would not fear God, fear Him in His land given to Israel. And He said, "The beast, I'll send the beast among you." And what did He do here? He sent the beast among them. In this case, a beast that was known or called specifically a lion. Okay, again, and consequently, once again, nothing, again, is proven by that passage, those first two passages, about Kehi being human. Okay, let's go now to Jeremiah chapter 27 and verse 6. And I want to read this one in the King James Version. Jeremiah 27 and verse 6, here's what it says. "And now have I given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and the beast Kehi of the field. Have I given him also to serve him?" Now, Here's our current speaker's or preacher's argument. He says, quote, "Now at this point, I want us to learn the most significant thing of all about the beasts of the earth that has followed them all through history," end quote. And then he goes on in somewhat of a dialogue to explain how the Negroes have always been a servant people. And then regarding particularly or specifically this passage, he then says, quote, "Animals could not be able to act as servants to the king, but the bipeds," which he's never established, "hands and feet creatures," which he never established, "living creatures who talk and articulate," which was based only on Genesis 3:1, which is certainly an obscure passage, who ate olives and grapes, which was never established, "now we find them being servants, end quote. Now, I want to center in on what his statement where he said, "Animals could not be able to act as servants to the king." Well, who says that animals couldn't act as servants to the king? Let me ask you this. What did the ravens do for Elijah? You remember the story about the ravens and Elijah? Turn with me to 1 Kings in chapter 17. First Kings 17, verses 2 through 6. It says, "And the word of Yahweh came to him, saying, Go away from here and turn eastward and hide yourself by the brook Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. And it shall be that you shall drink of the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to provide for you there. So he went and did according to the word of Yahweh. For he went and lived by the brook Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. And the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening, and he would drink from the brook." Now let me ask you, what did the ravens do? Yes, they brought bread and meat to him, but what would you call that? I'd call it serving, that God sent the ravens to serve Elijah. As a matter of fact, the ravens did for Elijah what Obadiah did for the 100 prophets just shortly hereafter in 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse 4. Look what it says. For it came about when Jezebel destroyed the prophets of Yahweh that Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50s in a cave and provided them with bread and water. Now, did Obadiah serve the 100 prophets? I'll guarantee you the 100 prophets looked upon it as being as him serving them. And it uses the exact same word. Obadiah provided for the 100 prophets, and the ravens provided the same Hebrew word for Elijah. Not only that, but in Jeremiah 27 and verse 6, you don't need to turn there, the word serve, which is the passage where it's under consideration, the word serve in that passage is number 5647 in Strong's Concordance. It's the Hebrew word abad. And in Exodus 29, it is the word translated labor and is applied to animals in verse 10. This preacher said that the animals couldn't serve King Nebuchadnezzar. Couldn't be talking about that. And yet here is the word serve, being used for animals in Exodus 20 and verses 9 and 10. In Isaiah 30 and 24, it is the word translated ear in the King James Version, or work in the New American Standard Version, and it is applied to oxen and donkeys specifically. So certainly, it is actually rather easily proven that animals could serve King Nebuchadnezzar in Jeremiah 27 and verse 6, and consequently this passage does not prove that beasts are Negro once again. Now, our last passage in this regard to be considered in relation to the beasts of the field that is sometimes used to try to prove again that they are human or Negro or whatever is found in Daniel 4 and verse 25. Now, in this particular case, it is used, though in this case it is not the word kehi, but it is the word chevya. Finally, we go back to our initial preacher, and we finally come up with a passage that uses the word that he says is used in all of these verses. Daniel 4 and verse 25. And it is also a passage relative to King Nebuchadnezzar. Here's what it says. Verse 25. "That you be driven away from mankind." This is the fulfillment of the dream, the fulfillment of the dream that Daniel interpreted for King Nebuchadnezzar. Part of it he says, that verse 25, that you be driven away from mankind and your dwelling place be with the beast of the field, and you be given grass to eat like cattle and be drenched with the dew of heaven. And seven periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. Again, at the very beginning, he says that part of the dream was to be fulfilled for Nebuchadnezzar in that he would be driven away from mankind and his dwelling place would be with the beast, Chevyah, of the field. Now, here's our previous preacher's argument in relation to this particular passage. He said, quote, "Now you're not seriously going to tell me tonight that when Nebuchadnezzar lost his senses, lost his mind, lost his reason, that he went out and was looked out after either by wild animals or domesticated animals." And then later he continued and he said, quote, "Do you really mean to tell me that a sheep or a goat or a cow or a dog or a cow or a cat or any other domesticated animals looked after Nebuchadnezzar for 7 years, made sure he had his food at mealtimes, made sure he had his drink and looked after, took care of him, trimmed his toenails, trimmed his beard, cut his hair, took care of him for 7 years of insanity," end quote. Again, if you just hear that argument and you don't check into what's really taking place and what the rest of the scriptures certainly make clear, a lot of people could be taken in by that kind of argument. But first of all, no one trimmed his hair or toenails. I mean, this, again, how specifically this particular preacher, how dishonest he was is just beyond me in almost every single statement he made. But no one or nothing trimmed his toenails or his hair. Look at verse 33. It specifically says that. It says, "Immediately the word concerning Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled, and he was driven away from mankind and began eating grass like cattle. And his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws." You ever seen somebody who doesn't trim their nails? They curl. They get out here a certain distance and they start curling just like bird's claws. Nobody trimmed his hair. Nobody trimmed his nails. So neither man nor beast did that. Secondly, it doesn't say that the beast served Nebuchadnezzar in this passage at all. He says that's what's being proclaimed here. It doesn't say it. Look at verse 23. It says, "And in that the king saw an angelic watcher, a holy one, descending from heaven and saying, 'Chop down the tree and destroy it, yet leave the stump with its root in the ground, but with a band of iron and bronze around it in the new grass of the field, and let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him share with the beasts of the field until seven periods of time passes over him.'" It doesn't say it anywhere in this passage. It doesn't say that the beast served Nebuchadnezzar. It says that he was to share with them. And if you look over in the footnote for the word "let him share," or for the phrase there, the footnote in the New American Standard says, "and his portion be with." Let his portion be with the beast of the field. And then look at back to verse 25 and verse 8, and it shows us what it's talking about. It says that you be driven away from mankind and your dwelling place be with the beast of the field. His portion was to be with. He was to dwell with, and explains what his portion to be with meant. He was to be out there in the field like an animal. That was God's judgment upon him. It doesn't say anything about animals serving Nebuchadnezzar in this passage, even though we've already proven in the previous passage that animals could have served him if that's what God had planned for him. And maybe they did, but it certainly doesn't say that. Thirdly, what is meant by beast in this passage is interpreted in verse 15 and 25b. Look at verse 15 of chapter 4. It says, "Yet leave the stump with its root in the ground, but with a band of iron and bronze around it, in the new grass of the field, and let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him share with the beast in the grass of the earth." Now, it uses the word Chevyah again there for beast, but it identifies what these beasts did. He says, "Let him share with the beast in the grass of the earth." Now look at verse 25 and part B of that verse. Notice it says, "And you be given grass to eat like cattle." Behemoth. Now we know what the beasts were in this passage. They were cattle. And behemoth certainly doesn't just mean bovines, but and we'll see at the end of this message what behemoth means. But the type of animal which ate grass. In other words, he went out and that's what he ate. He ate grass for 7 years, just like the cattle, shared in it with them. And so, once again, consequently, beasts in this passage are interpreted very clearly to be animals. If you just read the whole passage and accept all that it says. Now, that was our last passage, but our previous preacher, the one that I'm quoting on this particular passage, also stated regarding this passage something that was very interesting that I thought I ought to bring out as well. He said, quote, "Who was looking after him? His living creatures?" Or excuse me, I phrased that in a question, it should have been a statement. He said, "Who was looking after him? His living creatures, his black servants, the Negro people who had brought as his spoils of the Negro people he had brought as his spoils of war when he captured Jerusalem. You say," quote within a quote, "there weren't any Negroes in Jerusalem," end of quote within a quote. Well, you read the book of if you read the book of Jeremiah, you'll find that Abed-Melech, who was the servant of Jeremiah, was a Negro. He was a dark person. He was an Ethiopian out of that part of Africa, end quote. Now, let me tell you, you'll find no such thing. We read of Abed-Melech in Jeremiah 38 and verse 10. You'll need to turn there. And there he is called Abed-Melech the Ethiopian. That much he's correct on. And he was a servant of Jeremiah. But if you look up the word Ethiopian, here's what it says. It's number 3569, the Hebrew word cushi. Here's its definition. Patronymically, from 3568, a Cushite, or descendant of Cush. Strong's definition. He said it was from 3568. Here's 3568. It's the Hebrew word Cush. Probably of foreign origin, Cush, in parentheses, or Ethiopia, in parentheses, the name of the son of Ham and his territory. Strong's definition once again. Now let me ask you, who was Ham? Bible quiz time. One of the three sons of Noah, right. And so Cush was what? A grandson of Noah, right? Now, you're not going to try to tell me, are you, that the grandson of Noah, Cush, like some today try to, was the father of the Negro race. Are you going to try to tell me that? I hope not. It's impossible. Genetically, it's impossible, unless indeed God did curse. That was the curse upon Ham and Canaan, which wasn't the curse at all. You know, that they totally, again, didn't read their Bible to find out what the curse was. That wasn't the curse. Cush was not black. Now, in light of that, he's wrong. That Ethiopian, and as it's found translated in the King James, I think in probably every case in the Old Testament, is translated from Cush, and it means talking about a descendant of the grandson of Noah, which could not have been black. But what's interesting in light of that is this is part of how this particular preacher concluded his message. Here's what he said. Quote, "If you think what I have said is harsh," about the beasts of the field he's talking about them being the Negro race. He said again, quote, "If you think what I have said is harsh, think again what the churches say. Have I said something more harsh than those who say that the black man is the son of Ham and the black skin is a curse upon them? Is this not more cruel, more vicious, more unkind?" End quote. And yet that is exactly what he said when he said the Ethiopians are black, because he failed to check out the word, and the word means a descendant of Ham or a descendant of Cush. You know, he's done exactly what he accuses the Judeo-Christian churches of doing simply because he didn't do his homework. And again, as I pointed out when I first started quoting this particular man, there's a good lesson in this for us. Not just for him and not just for those who have listened to him. There's a good lesson in it for you. You'd better not trust your preacher, even if it's me. Because unless you check it out, as I mentioned before, you don't know whether he's lying or whether I'm lying to you. So you better check out your preacher. They may sound good. They may look handsome. They may be eloquent. I can't say that too well. But nonetheless, they may be liars. Or they may have, at the very least, not done their homework. I don't know which it is, but there's no excuse again for what this particular preacher did in this particular message. No, neither were the Ethiopians Negroes, nor were they the beast of the field. And no, there is absolutely no scriptural case in all of these scriptures that we've examined concerning the beast of the field for the beast of the field being looked upon as either Negroes or any other race of mankind. So, we've now proven what beasts of the field are not. So what are they? Well, let's see if we can't determine the true identity of these creatures in the Hebrew known as Kehi. And we're looking at just those known as Kehi because that's what's under consideration because we're dealing with the beast found in Genesis 1:24 and in Genesis 2. We are dealing only with the Kehi. So what are these creatures known as Kehi? Let's see what the scriptures really say. And here's where we'll nail the lid on the coffin. If the Kehi are Negroes, as some proclaim, and if we are consistent, then following are some other conclusions which must be drawn about these creatures as well. I want you to listen to these scriptures. You won't have time to turn to any of these. But listen to these scriptures which also use the word Kehi and note the conclusion, if we're going to be consistent, that must also be drawn. Here's Genesis 2 and verse 7. It says, "Then Yahweh God formed man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being." There are two words in that verse that are translated from the Hebrew word Kehi, the word life and the word living. In other words, it would read, if you put Kehi in there, it would read, God breathed into Adam the breath of Kehi, and Adam became a Kehi being, or soul, if you're reading the King James Version. Now, for those who want to make Kehi Negroes, let's see where their reasoning must lead them. In this case, they will have to admit that, quote, God breathed into Adam the breath of Negroes, and Adam became a Negro being, end quote. That's where their reasoning, if they're consistent with their teaching about Kehi being Negroes, must lead them. You know how ridiculous. The word Kehi just means life. And that's how Genesis 1 and verse 24 should be understood. It would have been actually much better translated, in my opinion, according to all the emphasis of this word or how it's used in the Scriptures in the Old Testament. It would have been much better translated the life in the field rather than beast of the field, in contrast with domesticated animals and reptilian life. It was the life in the field, the wildlife in the field. Now, with that having been stated, let's look at some other passages and see where their reasoning has to lead them, if indeed they are going to be consistent with what they teach. Genesis 3 and verse 20, for example, says, "Now the man called his wife's name Eve, because she was the mother of all the living." Kehi, in this passage, is the word living. In other words, Eve was the mother of all the Kehi in the Hebrew. And if the translators had been consistent, they would have had to have translated this verse, "Now the man called his wife's name Eve, because she was the mother of all beasts." And then, for those of you who want to make Kehi, or beasts, Negroes, you're going to have to admit, then, that Eve was the mother of all Negroes. Once again, how ridiculous. But, of course, in this case, Kehi is simply being used to designate that Eve was the beginning mother of the life of her people. And nobody's going to argue that. Genesis 6 and verse 19, consider. It says, "And every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every kind into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female." Kehi, in this case, is the phrase living thing. So did Noah just bring two of every subspecies of Negroes with him into the ark? Well, of course, we know that that's not what happened, but that's what they are forced to admit if Kehi equal Negroes. That Noah just gathered up his family and gathered up all the Negroes he could find and took a boat trip. You know, that's the conclusion. Let's go on. Genesis 7:11, it says, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month of the 17th day of the month, on the same day, all the fountains of the great deep burst open and the floodgates of the sky were open. Kehi is the word life here. And boy, did the translators blow it on this one. You know, it should have, of course, been translated in the 600th year of Noah's Negro. All of this happened. Genesis 9:3 says, every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I give all to you as I gave the green plant. Kehi here equals the word alive. Hey, you know what? Now that we know what Kehi should, Kehi, that is Kehi here, and now that we know the correct understanding for Kehi, we've missed an important food source for us. Here's obviously the proper translation. Every moving thing that is Negroid shall be food for you. We've missed it. You know, the Negroes here obviously were given to the white man as food. Well, that's the only conclusion you can come up with if Kehi are Negroes. Genesis 43 and verse 7, it says, but they said, the man questioned particularly about us and our relatives, saying, is your father still alive? Have you another brother? So we answered his questions. Could we possibly know that he would say, bring your brother down? Again, the word Kehi is the word alive here. And here we have, of course, the 10 sons of Jacob, or 10 of Jacob's sons, questioning or speaking to Jacob regarding Joseph's question about their father. And here is what they really, again, in this correct understanding of what Kehi is, here is what Joseph really asked. Is your father still a Negro? How about Deuteronomy 4 and verse 4? It says, But you who held fast to Yahweh your God are alive today, every one of you. Again, Kehi equals the word alive. Here's the way it should really read. But you who held fast to Yahweh your God are Negroes today, every one of you. Psalm 69 and verse 28, regarding the wicked, it says, may they be blotted out of the book of life, and may they not be recorded with the righteous. Kehi in this case is translated the word life in the phrase, the book of life. So really what we should be concerned with is being blotted out of the book of Negroes. Proverbs 8 and verse 35, speaking of instruction, it says, for he who finds me, instruction, finds life and obtains favor from Yahweh. Again, Kehi is translated life. So consequently, this should be understood as saying, he who finds instruction has found Negroes. Or how about Ecclesiastes 9:4, where it says, for whoever is joined with the living, there is hope. Of course, it should be correctly translated, for whoever is joined with Negroes, there is hope. And of course, that certainly kiboshes any interracial marriage prohibition, doesn't it? And then for the last one that I'll use, and I mean, it's amazing how many more we could have used in the same light, but in Jeremiah 10:10, I saved this one for the last. It says, but Yahweh is the true God. He is the living God and the everlasting King. Here, Kehi is translated the word living. Now, keep in mind that those who teach that Kehi are Negroes have no choice in being consistent but to interpret this verse as follows. But Yahweh is the true God. He is the Negro God. If they're consistent, they have no choice but to come up with those conclusions on all those passages and all the other ones I could have used throughout the Old Testament. Well, of course, this is all very ridiculous, and hopefully those who teach that Kehi are Negroes will see just how ridiculous their position really is. It just will not and cannot stand scripturally. Well, through all of that, we still haven't found out exactly what the beasts of the field are. So, let's see if these scriptures now that we want to examine will help us in discovering their true identity. And when we finish with these, I think there will be absolutely no doubt what these creatures are. Let's begin by turning to Genesis chapter 37. Genesis 37, and I want to look at verses 20 and 33. Verse 20, it says, "Now then, come and let us kill him." It's his brothers speaking about Joseph as he's come to search them out. Again, verse 20, "Now then, come and let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we will say, a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams." And then jump down to verse 33. Now they have taken the cloak back, the coat of many colors of Joseph, back to their father. And he responds by saying, "Then he examined it and said, 'It's my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces.'" The word beast there, and in every case, in every one of these passages, unless I'm lying to you, is the word kehi. In this case, the kehi are made responsible for tearing Joseph apart and devouring him. Now, the King James Version translates, rather than wild beast here, they translate it evil beast. And someone may say, well, only humans can be considered to be evil. Well, evil is number 7451 in Strong's Concordance. It's the Hebrew word ra. And in Genesis 41, verses 19 through 21, it is used in relation to cattle. And then in 2 Kings 4 and verse 41, or 2 Kings 4 and verse 41, translates this same Hebrew word as harm in relation to a pot of poisoned stew. So in other words, Genesis 37, 20 and 33 could have been translated a harmful beast rather than an evil beast, as the King James put it. The New American Standard simply chose to translate it as a wild beast. But nonetheless, there's no argument in trying to do something with the word evil there either. But here we can see the first identifying mark of these beasts is that they were attributed as having torn apart and devouring Joseph. Now let's go to the next one, which will be Leviticus chapter 11. Leviticus chapter 11, beginning with verses 2 and 3. Note that it says, "Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, 'These are the creatures,'" King James, I believe, translates it beasts. It's number 2416, kehi. It says, "Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, 'These are the kehi, which you may eat from all the animals, behemoth, that are on the earth. Whatever divides the hoof, thus making split hoofs, and choose the cud among the animals that you may eat.'" We can see from these two verses, first, that kehi can be either clean or unclean animals or creatures. Two, that they divide the hoof and or chew the cud. And three, that those of the clean category can be eaten by man. Doesn't leave much room for Negroes, does it? Let's go to now, continuing in Leviticus 11, in the following verses, 4 through 7, these creatures are specifically identified for us, what they are, so there can be no doubt. Verse 4, "Nevertheless, you are not to eat of these among those which chew the cud." Now, keep in mind that these creatures are beasts, these kehi, can be either clean or unclean. Now it's going to deal with the unclean beasts. Verse 4, "Nevertheless, you are not to eat of these, among those which chew the cud, or among those which divide the hoof, the camel. For though it chews the cud, it does not divide the hoof. It is unclean to you. Likewise, the rock badger. For though it chews cud, it does not divide the hoof. It is unclean to you. The rabbit also. For though it chews cud, it does not divide the hoof. It is unclean to you. And the pig, for though it divides the hoof, thus making a split hoof, it does not chew the cud." Consequently, we have these kehi being specifically identified as being camels, rock badgers, rabbits, pigs, etc., as what we should understand them to be. Then jump over to Leviticus 11:27. It identifies these creatures as walking on all 4 feet. Verse 27, it says, "And also whatever walks on its paws among all the creatures or beasts that walk on all four are unclean to you. Whoever touches these carcasses becomes unclean until evening." So they're not only we have them very specifically identified for us, but now we know they are creatures indeed that walk on all four. Now, we've already also seen, we won't look at this passage since we've already examined it previously, but in Leviticus 25, 6 and 7, as we saw earlier in this very message, it categorizes beast as something different from Israelites, different from slaves, different from hired help, different from foreigners, non-Israelites, and also different from cattle, domestic animals. And again, what's that leave us? it leaves us again wild animals, for the most part, which is the most generally used or the most often way that the word kehi is used. Now let's go to Numbers chapter 35 through 33. We'll find another identifying mark of these beasts. Numbers 35 and verse 3. It says, "And a city shall be theirs to live in," speaking of the Levites, "and their pasture lands shall be for their cattle," Behemoth 9:29, "and for their herds, and for all their beasts," number 24:16, Kehi. So, we now know that these Kehi were pastured, just like you normally would animals. Now, turn to Psalms chapter 50. Psalms chapter 50, and verses 7 through 13, reveal to us that they are one of the things, quote-unquote, eaten by God. Starting with verse 7, it says, "Hear, O my people, and I will speak, O Israel. I will testify against you. I am God your God. I do not reprove you for your sacrifices, and your burnt offerings are continually before me. I shall take no young bull out of your house, nor male goats out of your folds. For every beast, kehi, of the forest is mine, the cattle, behemoth, on 1,000 hills. I know every bird of the mountains, and everything that moves in the field is mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine and all it contains. Shall I eat the flesh of bulls, or drink the blood of male goats?" A redundant question. He's saying, hey, You're not doing me some big favor by sacrificing to me your bulls and goats. I've got all the cattle on 1,000 hills, and I own all the beasts out there as well. If I'm hungry, I'll eat them. Your sacrifice is not something done for me. You see the point? And so here, God identifies the beast, the kehi, as something, quote-unquote, eaten by God. Psalms 104 will be our next passage. Again, helping us to understand what these kehi truly are. Psalms 104, starting with verses 10 and 11. Again, we're going to get specific in this chapter. Verse 10 and 11, it says, "He sends forth springs in the valleys, they flow between the mountains. They give drink to every beast, kehi, of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst." So here, they're specifically identified as being wild donkeys. Let's go to Psalms 104, verses 20 and 21. Here it says, "Thou dost appoint darkness, and it becomes night, in which all the beasts, kehi, of the forest prowl about. The young lions roar after their prey and seek their food from God." Now we have them identified specifically as lions. In Isaiah 40, in verse 16, kehi are used as a burnt offering. I'll turn there quickly and read it. Isaiah 40, verse 16 says, "Even Lebanon is not enough to burn, nor its beasts," 24:16 kehi, "enough for a burnt offering." Isaiah 43, in verse 20, identifies kehi as being jackals and ostriches. Isaiah 43, verse 20, "And the beast, kehi, of the field will glorify me, the jackals and the ostriches." And then in Hosea, chapter 13, and verses 7 and 8 identifies kehi as being lions, leopards, and bears. Listen to what it says. Hosea 13, verse 7 and 8. "So I will be like a lion to them. Like a leopard I will lie in wait by the wayside. I will encounter them like a bear robbed of her cubs, and I will tear open their chests. There I will also devour them like a lioness, as a wild beast would tear them. As lions, leopards, and bears, oh my." The beasts, the kehi are. And then lastly, in Zephaniah chapter 2 and verses 13 and 14, we find here that the kehi are identified as being pelicans and hedgehogs. Chapter 2, verses 13 and 14, it says, "And he will stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria, and he will make Nineveh a desolation, parched like the wilderness. And flocks will lie down in her midst, all beasts, kehi, which range in herds, both the pelican and the hedgehog. Now, having gone through those passages, which clearly, without any problem, which identify the Kehi in this manner, let me ask you, is there any doubt now what the beasts of the field are not and what the beasts of the field are, as recorded in Genesis 1 and verse 24? Beast, Kehi, are identified in these passages that I just went through as being, one, that which tore apart and devoured Joseph, either clean or unclean creatures, creatures which divide the hoof and chew the cud, that which can be eaten by men, creatures that walk on all four feet, something different from Israelites, slaves, hired help, foreigners, which are non-Israelites, and cattle, domestic animals. Seven, which are pastured, creatures which are quote-unquote eaten by God, creatures which could be used as burnt offerings, and specifically identified as camels, rock badgers, rabbits, pigs, wild donkeys, jackals, ostriches, pelicans, hedgehogs, lions, leopards, and bears. Oh my. Now, is anyone going to take these 10 identifying characteristics and assign them to human beings? Now, I don't think anyone now is going to be foolish enough to make such a judgment. So, we are left with this obvious conclusion, that the beasts of the field in Genesis 1 and 2 are simply animals, most often used to describe wild animals as implied in the term, or terms, beast of the field and beast of the earth. That is simply the case. Now, I should say, now that we've eliminated man, living creatures, and beast of the earth or beast of the field as being the creation of the other races, inevitably, based on what I've seen some do already, inevitably, now that we've done that, someone is probably going to come along and suggest that the cattle or the behemoth in Genesis 1:24 is where we uncover the other races of mankind. So, and it only takes a small amount of time. Just a small amount of time must be devoted toward diffusing this possible, improbable hypothesis. Let me begin by reminding you of the Hebrew definition for the word translated beast in Genesis 1:24, taken from both the Strong's Concordance and Jesenius' Hebrew Chaldee lexicon. It's the word behemoth or behemoth in the plural. They are defined as being, from both of these sources, four-legged animals, most often domesticated beasts of burden. That's how the word has been defined by these Hebrew scholars. Secondly, here is what is revealed from an analysis of scriptures which use the word behemoth or behemoth, number 929 or number 930. Here is what's discovered. And I've got all the scripture references written down here, but it would be too lengthy for me to give you every one of them. If you want them, you can ask for them. Here's what's revealed from these scriptures that use this word. That the behemoth, that they could be given a clean, or they are given a clean or unclean designation, that they once again divide the hoof and chew the cud, that they could be used as an offering to Yahweh, that they were to be devoted along with the firstborn Israelites and the Levites to Yahweh, that they could be eaten by the sons of Israel, that they were quote-unquote eaten by God, that they were categorized different from Israelites, hired help, and strangers, that they were considered the same as livestock, herds, or flocks, that they were pastured, that they ate grass, or that they eat grass, that they were penned or corralled, that they were ridden, and that they were represented specifically as donkeys, oxen, sheep, goats, camels, rock badgers, rabbits, pigs, cattle, deer, gazelle, roebuck, wild goat, ibex, antelope, mountain sheep, horses, mules, and lions. And you can see with both the word behemoth and the word kehi that there is some crossover. It's not exclusively domesticated animals and wild animals. There is some crossover, and sometimes behemoth is used for some wild animals, and sometimes kehi is used for some domestic animals. But very clearly, for anybody who wants to, for their last straw attempt, try to somehow find the races in Genesis 1 and verse 24, Behemoth just won't work. Obviously, the non-Caucasian races of man are not to be found in Behemoth either. Now, would someone dare try to force humankind or the other races into the term living creatures in Genesis 1:24? That's really their last straw. I really doubt whether anybody's going to try to do that. But just in case, let me quote the Hebrew definition for the crawling creatures found in Genesis 1:24. The phrase comes from number 7431. It's the Hebrew word remes. Comes from 7430, according to Strong's Concordance. It's a reptile or any other rapidly moving animal. According to Jesenius' Hebrew Chaldee Lexicon of the Old Testament, it's a reptile, collectively reptiles. Often, whatever creeps on the ground, often used of aquatic animals, of all land animals, whatever, in Genesis 9 and verse 3. Again, according to Jesenius' Hebrew Chaldee Lexicon to the Old Testament. As an outcome of all of this, we can see that the other races of mankind are clearly not to be found in Genesis 1 and 2. They're just totally not mentioned. Again, I believe that some of our people have tried to take these scriptures or these terms and tried to force them to say something they haven't said in order to clear up some what have seemed to be some unanswerable questions in the past. But that's just what they've done. They force the scriptures very clearly to say something they don't say at all, because the other races are neither man, nor the living creatures, nor the beast of the field, nor cattle, nor creeping things in Genesis 1 and 24. You just, if you're scripturally accurate with God's word, you cannot force any of those beings into being the other races of mankind. So let me leave you with this question, with this particular message. And that is, with this being the case, is there any reason why Genesis 1 and 2 should not be considered two different accounts of the same creation? We'll deal with that in the message yet to come. Let's stand and we'll close in prayer.